Despite near eradication 15 years ago, cases of the measles are growing again in the U.S., with more than 100 confirmed cases across 14 states. The outbreak is linked to people who visited Disneyland in Southern California the third week in December. Top U.S. health officials and President Obama are urging parents to get their children vaccinated. But pushback from the anti-vaccination movement continues, charged by fears of side effects. Some school officials are firing back by banning unvaccinated children from the classroom. We'll examine the latest measles outbreak and look at public health policy regarding vaccinations for childhood diseases. It's Midday on Health with Dr. John Smarr after the news from NPR. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. Our second hour, Dan Roderick's here. Thanks again for joining us. According to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, there are now more than 100 cases of the measles being reported across 14 states. The director of the CDC says he was very concerned over the outbreak, and he urged parents to get their children vaccinated. President Obama echoed those sentiments. New Jersey Governor Chris Christie deviated from that a little bit, instead saying that the government needs to balance public health interests with parental choice. That was, since then, Governor Chris Christie walked back those comments. I was just handed this note from the Washington Post, a story from the Washington Post that says that statement he made about calling for balance on the measles vaccine debate to allow for parental choice, saying now that there is no question kids should be vaccinated. So I guess that you'd call that walking back that statement. Anyway, we're going to talk about this hour. The CDC reports that the childhood vaccination rate nationwide is about 92%. It's lower in certain parts of the country, such as Southern California, which is known as an anti-vaccination area. Parents in those communities maintain their resistance to vaccinations because of a fear that vaccinations could potentially cause autism. We've heard that. Also because there seems to be mistrust of the pharmaceutical industry, or they just want to, observe sort of a natural process, I guess. John Smarr is here. Dr. John Smarr joining us again. Well, I'm trying to describe that sort of second part of this anti-vaccine movement, John. It started a long time ago, but the connection to autism, which has been debunked, mm-hmm. That gave it energy within the last 10 years or so. And now it seems to be people who want a natural approach to health and just don't like the idea of injecting chemicals into their children.
Right, and I think that's probably the best way to use those words. And what's interesting is, you're struggling right now to try to
describe that.
Yeah. And that struggle is an important thing to focus on, because the problem is that, and this is something that we've talked about before, we have in terms of public health, in terms of medical things in general, we have a challenge with regards to terminology. And it is that there's been a shift that some people use the word natural and they want that to have a very specific meaning. So they actually view the products of science, no matter what those are, and put quotes around that phrase, products of science, as being a thing that is unnatural, that is, I don't know, more rife with toxicity, let's mm-hmm. say, that could cause more harms. And so there's a very sort of a postmodernist movement in the United States of people wanting to move beyond, because back, let's say, 50s, 60s, back then, 40s even, the promise of science, that was all in the marketing. If you look at the TV commercials of the era, the radio commercials of the era, the amazing things we'll be able to do with plastic, how science is going to be
better living through chemistry.
Yes, better living through chemistry.
And 9 out of 10 doctors recommend whatever.
Precisely, right? Precisely. Yeah. And then, of course, it turns out that some of these products and things that we came up with did not come out to pass, that they weren't perfectly healthy, that there are side effects from, you know, industrial processes, that some of the compounds that people made, they're, you know, later on concerns over causing cancer and having unintended side effects. And so sort of the modern backlash about that is that, well, to lump everything that we do in terms of medications, in terms of vaccines, in terms of some interventions into this bucket of this is not natural. And so nature is untampered with, is that we human beings haven't tampered with it at all. And so therefore eating food that we haven't tried to modify or taking medicines that are very straightforward, that we haven't been mucked about with in a lab or we didn't create ourselves. I think that's sort of the spirit of what you're trying to capture. And the problem is that people have co-opted the word natural, and it's for marketing. It's now a marketing word.
Yeah. It doesn't allow for the other natural idea that there's an evolution to human thinking and understanding, and science advances, evolves, and our understanding of things is heightened. And therefore, we can take better care of ourselves and live longer.
Right.
Right?
Exactly. I mean, the challenge is, you know, people talk about, and I apologize, this is a little off topic, but people talk about natural versus other foods and sort of, okay, if natural foods are things that you just grow and you don't use any extra chemicals or pesticides and you're not doing anything to, then that's how it was occurring in nature. However, when we use those things, we're doing things to alter and protect our crops in a very heavy-handed way. But farmers, ever since humans learned about agriculture, we have done things with our agricultural techniques to modify our crops. We've selected things. It hasn't been in this more direct way since we've had scientific advances. And so it's a point that we're sort of on this continuum. It's not that there's natural and not, there's just a continuum of things that we've always done to everything that we encounter as human beings that plays into that definition.
This is Midday on Health with Dr. John Smarr. Dr. Smarr is Assistant Director of the Division of Infectious Diseases at Sinai Hospital in Baltimore. If you know from listening to Midday on Health, Dr. John's expertise in infectious diseases. He's also Program Director of Sinai's Internal Medicine Residency Program, joining us here in this hour to answer your questions about measles, about vaccinations, about childhood diseases. 410-662-8780 is the way to reach us regionally. And our toll-free long-distance number, 866-661-9309. You can also submit a question or comment by email at midday@wypr.org. Lots of interesting stories related to this. Over the weekend, John, that we've been sharing on social media and learning more about this outbreak. We'll go over some things we went over the last time you were on the show.
Mm-hmm.
Here's a disease that was pretty much considered eradicated 15 years ago. And in recent years, we've seen an increase in the number of confirmed cases. And now we're at a place, what would you say about where we are now in terms of the numbers?
Well, in terms of the numbers, this is why this story is so big, is even with the cases we've seen over the last few years, the definition from back in the year 2000, when we finally had this under control of what the CDC said, that its transmission of measles in the United States was eradicated, was essentially saying over a year period, we were not seeing someone who is sick that we can then tie to making other people sick and having that be a transmission. So we've seen sporadic cases usually tied to travelers, say people coming from other countries coming into the United States, or some sort of an exposure like that. And usually these cases have involved folks who have not been vaccinated, at least predominantly. That's the people who's been affected. But the big deal with this is that now we are seeing that there was this event where there was an exposure. And now this is being transmitted and it's spreading. And again, we're not talking catastrophically huge numbers, but over 100 when we should have zero, and we have in the past made it to zero, is way too much. And that's when, today the CDC was coming out and saying that they are particularly concerned with what they're seeing epidemiologically in terms of this becoming an even bigger sort of an outbreak. Because as it spreads, I mean, we're in many, many states. It's down into Mexico. This is the biggest thing that we've seen for measles easily since 2000 and a long time in the United States.
Please talk a little bit about measles. For those of us assume we know what it's all about, what its symptoms are and what kind of damage it can do. Let's not assume that.
Right, absolutely. And so measles is a virus, and so a type of an organism. And of course, a virus is different from bacteria. Bacteria, we often say, is one of the tiniest things that we say is alive, and people dispute whether or not viruses are actually alive, but they're chunks of genes and proteins that you can pass from person to person and cause disease in people and in animals as well. And specifically with measles, it's a respiratory virus. So in that way, it's vaguely similar to something like influenza, namely you can cough it out, and being exposed to that, breathing it in, potentially touching a contaminated surface, wiping on eyes, nose, or mouth, you know, things that children especially are not terribly well-policed at doing. But some adults, I know my wife would argue that maybe even though I'm an infectious diseases specialist, I should probably be a little bit more hygienic, haha. But, you know, and so then you get this infection, and in most people, it's not a fatal thing. There's a very characteristic respiratory symptoms that you get, fever. There's a characteristic rash you can get. There are certain spots that you can actually see on the inside of the mouth. But the big problem is that in the majority of people, you get it, you have it. I believe you've had your own personal experience with it. We had actually talked about that last time.
When I was in the second grade, which is quite a while ago.
Right.
Some 50 years ago.
And most people get over it. But simultaneously, then, there is this small group of people who have even worse sequelae, even worse things as a result of the infection, which can include everything from cardiopulmonary stuff to neurologic things. The worst thing that we worry about is something like an encephalitis, inflammation around the brain. And usually when we talk about the few unfortunate folks, a few being relatively, in terms of numbers, who have died from the measles, that's what it is that it's due to, say, a pneumonia, or it's due to, say, this inflammation around the brain causing a problem.
When you say relatively few in terms of fatalities, the numbers I've seen on this were 400 to 500 deaths per year up until the time that vaccine came into play, which was 1963.
Correct.
Is that about right?
Yeah, and the thing I don't want to understate is that the worst possible scenario would be for it to infect a pregnant woman and have it be passed on to the baby in utero while the baby is still inside of her, because you're talking a range of congenital abnormalities, you're talking potential for fetal death. And so that is probably the most of all the things that we see and we're concerned about with measles, that has got to be up there at the top, if not the number one thing.
410-662-8780 is our phone number here. Let's go to the phone lines for questions for Dr. Smar. We'll start with Lucy in Lutherville. Go right ahead, Lucy. Hi.
Yes, hello.
Good. You're on the air.
Hi. My question is, I'm almost 57 years old, and I fortunately or unfortunately had all of the childhood diseases we now have vaccines for. So measles, German measles, mumps, scarlet fever, chicken pox, all that stuff. And I wonder, because it might be that I was just too young to have been aware of serious side effects, but I don't recall other children or my siblings having dire side effects. So is the disease that's out there now perhaps more dangerous to people who contract it because most others are immunized against it? I'm just wondering if it's a stronger strain of measles or other diseases that might be endangering people.
Right. Thank you very much for the question, Lucy. That's a very important thing to bring up. And right now, the thought is that we are not dealing with a significantly different strain that's going around, or something that is more deadly. It's more just that we're looking at the issues surrounding vaccination, and that it was this one traveler, for instance, in this particular instance, who brought it in, and then a susceptible group of people. But it doesn't appear to have anything to do with a particular change in the measles virus itself.
What does MMR stand for again?
Measles, mumps, and rubella.
Rubella. Thank you, John. Should adults who had the MMR vaccine as a child get another vaccine or booster now, given the rise of cases of measles? I am 42 years old. This is a question from Kelly on Facebook.
So that's a question that obviously we're all thinking about, and should it be, and I certainly hope that measles doesn't come to Maryland, let's say, in terms of a big deal, that's something that's going to be raised. And right now, there are certain populations that we generally would recommend vaccination for who are adults or going through that particular process, namely folks who are healthcare workers or folks who are going to be in close institutions where if someone gets a infection like the measles, it will be easy to spread it from person to person. In terms of the general population, I think that's something that if someone is concerned about it, I would definitely recommend talking to your personal physician. And specifically, a good reason for that is that there are different approaches that for different people might make sense. In some cases, especially if we saw that an outbreak was coming to a head in Maryland, that would be something that if someone wanted to be screened, some people might say, go ahead and just get the shot, get a booster. There's nothing in terms of the downside to that. The side effects, relatively speaking, minimal, few, likely none for the vast majority of people. Some other folks, you might argue, well, depending on when you last had your shots, you could do, and we talked about this last time, a blood test, namely to see, do you have the right levels of the antibodies? Has your immune system made the antibodies to protect you from the virus? And so you could do the blood test
first. Is that a fairly easy test to get done?
It's a straightforward common lab test that you can do. And most places, either they may do it in the hospital or they may send it out, like especially if you go to your own private lab, and you'll have the answer within a couple of days. And then
were concerned about that, you could ask that be done at a clinic or any clinic or your
doctor. Right, absolutely, yeah. But some people, in some cases, the physician may say, ah, let's just go ahead and give you a booster. And I don't see, as opposed to going through, you know, the testing.
You don't see the downside to the booster.
Right.
I don't want to put words in your mouth.
Absolutely. No, I don't. Okay. And in fact, for some, the purest way to go about it would be to say, get the test first. But there are some circumstances, especially for folks, if you're challenged with regards to insurance or paying the copay, say, for lab tests, it may be the most economical thing. The easiest thing will be, well, let's not worry about the lab test. Let's just go ahead and give you the shot.
Dr. John Smarr is with us. We're talking about the measles outbreak. We'll talk some more about vaccines, childhood vaccinations, and inoculations. I have some questions for Dr. Smarr, and I bet you do too. 410-662-8780 is our number. And again, you can send a question in by email, midday@wypr.org. We'll be right back. Hey, over the weekend, so lots of chatter about this on the internet, of course, about the measles outbreak, about the anti-vaccine movement, their contribution to this outbreak. But somebody raised a question on Facebook, and I wanted to ask you about this. It was Fiona who posted this comment. In those days when she was younger, the number of vaccines was a lot more reasonable than today. I'm 47. I just got 5 vaccines. Now it's up to 45. And I think she means, I looked at on the state of Maryland's health department's website. I think she means shots and booster shots for children before the age of 6. It wasn't 45, but it was a fairly high number. It was like 35 or something like that. So let's talk about that a little bit. I guess since Fiona was a kid, there have been new and improved vaccinations. That's number one, I would guess. Go ahead. Let me hear from you on that, John, because 45 jumps out to a lot of people. That's a lot of shots that'd be given children before they're 6 years old.
Right, absolutely. And so people think about, you know, your poor child, and especially, too, as if a particular child has a problem getting needles, has a particular fear, and no one wants to really be injected with anything, right?
So
you can certainly see where that's coming from, and I believe what you said is correct in terms of that number represents not 45 different vaccines itself, but 45 different total shots or cumulative numbers of shots when you can look at a whole list.
Hepatitis, rotavirus, diphtheria, tetanus, pertussis, an important one, right? You can help me with that one. Pneumococcal, right? How'd
yes.
I do?
That was good. You got it right.
Thank you. Hepatitis A, measles, mumps, rubella, meningococcal.
Mm-hmm.
How'd I do with that?
That was also pretty good.
Okay, that's just a part of the list. Well, that's most of it, but anyway.
Right.
So these 45 shots that she's refers to the first inoculation and boosters.
Mm-hmm. And so I think let's back up and just re-clarify to make sure that everybody understands. We all sort of think we know what a vaccine is, but at a very basic philosophical standpoint, the idea is that why we want to give vaccines is because when we are exposed to these things, they make us very sick and can cause us to die and sometimes can cause us to be sick or potentially disabled for the remainder of our lives. And so what we figured out at one point was that we can somehow take the actual bugs that can cause the illness and we can do things to them to make them ideally able to trigger the same immune response that you would have if you got the infection, which would then hopefully prevent you from getting the infection again, if exposed to it again, but to not make you as sick as you actually would have been had you gotten the illness in the first place. And the goal, ultimate goal, of course, would be to develop vaccines that don't have any side effects that wouldn't make you sick at all. And the reality, though, of the world we live in, of course, is that we think about these in a very small scale. Like you think about, okay, each look at this list of each of these individual vaccines that we're getting. But the reality is that, especially for kids, you know, we live in this just this soup of pathogens that we run into on a daily basis. We've talked before about we all have the normal flora of billions of bacteria on our skin, in our gut, in our nose, mouth. Think about kids with snotty secretions. Mm-hmm. And it's not just bacteria. We're learning over the years more and more that there we have normal viruses. And that's a really interesting topic that don't typically cause us any problems, but also live inside of our bodies. And so when we go out and are interacting with the daily world, we are exposed to a vast number of these things. Your immune system is constantly being challenged, especially, again, as you're young, by exposure to different bacteria, different viruses, different things in the environment. And we're still trying to link up what that means in terms of people's immunity. But the idea that maybe getting so many shots, at least from the standpoint of how your immune system is handling things, that maybe we're giving too much and it somehow could overwhelm the immune system and cause problems. As far as we can tell, there's nothing behind that, because even getting all of these shots with these challenges with these different microbes, we're still, the average child is being constantly exposed to all the, to different things and more. So it's not like the immune system can be overwhelmed. One of the other concerns that people would think about that is you can find lists, of course, online of what all is in vaccines, because it ends up that you have other chemicals, other substances that are sort of byproducts of having made the vaccine. And some people will look at that list and they'll, for lack of a better word, have concern about, well, what is this stuff that we're mm-hmm. injecting into people? For instance, one of the classic things that some of the anti-vaccine folks have said is, so look at the list of what's in the standard flu vaccine. There's formaldehyde in that, and we know what formaldehyde is used for. It's used for preserving bodies. That's a horrible toxic chemical that it turns out we all have inside of our own bodies. It's part of our natural process that our bodies make formaldehyde. When you look at a list of some of the other things that are in vaccines, one of the things that you can obviously point out is think of what's in your, if you think that the drinking water coming from your tap is just water, then that's incorrect. There's a ton of different things that in trace amounts can show up in there. And there's a reason behind each of the ingredients that's in the vaccine. And at the end of the day, there's no appreciable toxicity from any of these things in those levels. And so it's not like getting a whole bunch of shots. There's nothing to that idea that you're going to be getting a toxicity, at least that we can see, from getting all of these shots from what is inside of them.
410-662-8780, again, is our phone number for Dr. John Smarr. Question by email from Meredith on the second measles vaccine dose. Are children who have only had the first of their two shots protected?
They are protected. The whole point of the booster, the whole concept of doing a booster for a vaccine, and again, every vaccine is different in how it was developed, and so each one is studied individually to say, okay, when we give this to a certain group of people, what percentage of those people get protected from it? And so usually when we're doing boosters, it's because a vaccine was developed, we gave one shot, and not enough folks generated enough of an antibody response, got enough of a protection from just the one shot. And so that's why a decision was made, well, let's look at it and see if we give another shot, a booster shot. And, you know, some vaccines require three shots, because when they looked at it, they found that this series of shots, as opposed to just one shot, was very effective at protecting almost everyone who got the vaccine. So if someone just gets one shot, It's possible. It's certainly possible that they will have some protection. And again, the only way to sort of prove that we have would be to do this blood test to see what do you have in terms of antibodies. And I would think that most people would say that, you know, if someone, especially a child, did not get all of the recommended booster shots, the easiest thing to do would be to say, just go ahead and get the booster shot or redo the whole series.
Questions for Dr. John Smar. Again, welcome at 410-662-8780. Joan in Baltimore. Joan, you're on Midday on Health. Joan, are you there?
Oh, Joan, they had the wrong number. I was asking if a baby or babies under a year, 8 months old, in daycare in the Baltimore, Washington area should get a vaccine for measles and flu.
So thank you. That's a very good question. And what I will point out to you is, and I'll point out to everyone, is that on the website for the CDC, there is a vaccination schedule in terms of, and actually Dan has it up that he's looking at right now.
I've got the Maryland version.
Right, and there's
it.
The Maryland version. Yeah. It's the same in terms of the data.
Yeah.
But this is sort of, it encapsulates all the recommendations. It's very, very easy to find.
It says from measles, mumps, and rubella, minimum age for dose one is 12 months. But it says that dose one to dose two can be given at 4 weeks. Does that sound right to you, John?
Yes, that's absolutely correct.
Okay, that's in the cases of the MMR. Okay.
And it's based on the fact that when they originally studied these vaccines, where some of these recommendations comes from, it looks at the group of people who was picked and then who was studied in terms of getting the vaccines. And so it's possible to give them early. It's just that we have a routine set time in terms of who gets them when.
I see polio on here. It says, actually it says inactivated polio virus, minimum age for dose one is 6 weeks. Can be given dose one to dose two at 8 weeks. What does that mean, inactivated?
Well, that's an excellent question.
Inactivated polio virus.
It's a great question.
Well,
so some vaccines,
I'm a word guy. I'm wondering what word's doing there.
And so that's another level of complexity, but something that's worth touching on briefly is that, remember I said that each vaccine is sort of different, and the goal is to try to come up with a process to take the bug or the organism that you're trying to protect people against and make it into an effective vaccine. And so some vaccines are live but inactivated. That's what they're described as, meaning you still have a bug that is somehow still alive, but we've done something to it that means that it can't cause the full-blown infection. Polio is a great example because there's actually two polio vaccines. There's the inactivated polio vaccine, and there is the live, I'm sorry, there is the killed polio vaccine, and there is the live inactivated polio vaccine. And how those vaccines work that are still alive is that it causes a very low level infection. And so your body responds to that, and the hope is that you're not going to get sick from that. And most of the time when you see these live but inactivated vaccines, there will be warnings about if someone has an immune system problem, you shouldn't probably get that vaccine. So for instance, you have the two different types of the polio, you have two different types of the flu vaccine. So the flu mist, the one that you spray up inside of the nostrils of someone, is actually a live inactivated virus, which is not how the flu shot works, because the flu shot is the other type. It's essentially you have the organism's dead. It can't do anything. And so when we say, for instance, the flu shot can't make someone sick, it's because it doesn't actually contain any, it has chunks of the virus that your immune system can react to, but it doesn't actually have a live virus inside of it. Whereas the flu mist, you shoot it up into your nose, into your sinuses, and it causes a very low-level infection. But that's why you can see that there are some groups, like, for instance, folks who are asthmatics or other folks who have immune system problems, who probably shouldn't get that vaccine because in the off chance that that could still trigger problems, like even a low-level respiratory infection could cause a problem for an asthmatic, or other people with an immune system might be sicker with a very small infection as opposed to someone who is otherwise healthy.
So is that why two types were developed?
So the two types were, well,
or not, are they just responding to two phenomena?
Right. It's more the story is different for each vaccine. So it actually, with the polio one, it probably not worth it to get into it right now for time, but that's the difference really between the Salk and the Sabin vaccine. And it's all about different in there, it wasn't because someone decided we need to make two. It's two different people came up with two different ways to make those vaccines.
Speaking of two different, measles and German measles, a question from John. Is there a difference? Can you explain it?
Well, one is measles, which is measles, and then which is also known as rubeola, and then there's rubella, which has a nickname, I believe, if I'm not misstating it, of the German measles. So it's just you have a different, and also I believe the phrase German measles has been applied historically to different things as well. So it comes down to a word thing, but rubella has a nickname of German measles.
Tracy says, I'm amazed at the cognitive dissonance exhibited by some in the anti-vaccine movement. I do wonder what these same individuals do when they themselves are severely ill. Do they remain steadfast in their distrust of medical research and the pharmaceutical industry, using some natural remedy for their heart disease or broken leg? Or do they eagerly consume the medications and devices manufactured by the very same companies that they disparage? I wonder how these very same individuals feel about the Ebola and other epidemics that will hopefully be stemmed through vaccination. 410-662-8780 is our phone number here. Helen in Baltimore with a question for Dr. Smar.
Yeah, hi. Well, just in terms of that last caller, the medical care is a huge cause of death in this country, just for starters. But anyway, so the question, I didn't hear the whole discussion of the vaccines, and I heard about the formaldehyde, but I don't know if you actually mentioned thimerosal as the preservative in these vaccines that contains mercury, and it's a cumulative dose, so if every year you get a flu vaccination, you're getting and from what I understand, they've taken the mercury thimerosal out of children's vaccines because it's dangerous, and anyway, so I would sort of like to know what is the status of that, because it seems to me that that's one of the most important aspects of people not wanting to get vaccinations.
Dr. Smar?
Thank you for your question, Helen. And I will say that it does actually still drive this concern. Even some folks who are medical providers in terms of the advice that they give, which is unfortunate because that issue is pretty much settled. There is no association with thimerosal and anything with regards to toxicity or autism. But even I, a couple months ago, had a call from a patient who was coming in to see me, and there another physician that they interact with had actually counseled them. They said, well, when you get your flu shot, make sure you get one without the preservative. And essentially what the deal is with thimerosal is that it's a preservative. So specifically with some vaccines, and you had mentioned the flu vaccine, it comes in a multi-dose vial for the sake of ease. And so you have one vial and you're drawing some up and then you're administering it. You can use it to give to multiple patients. And so back in the day, they wanted to have a preservative that would allow it to stay fresh and not be contaminated with any microbials between its uses. And there was a concern that was raised as part of the interesting history of the anti-vaccine movement about whether or not thimerosal had anything to do with autism. And it led at one point to probably what is considered by many to be an incredible misstep on the part of the CDC, which was, now blanking on the specific year, but there was a year where the recommendation came down that, okay, because people are so afraid of this, then let's go ahead and remove it from vaccines. And what happened was many people saw this as the CDC saying, this was actually toxic. It was actually causing problems. And that's not actually true. It was done because someone was so concerned about the public level of concern that they made the decision to recommend, okay, let's take it out to hopefully quell the controversy, to make people worry less. And in fact, what it did, unfortunately, is it reinforced the idea that there are toxic things. So thimerosal is based on the element mercury, and this is getting into a little bit of chemistry, but there's two ways that typically we see mercury in the environment. There's elemental mercury, which is all over the place. It's in the environment. And it usually, as opposed to just being the pure element, will end up compounding into something in the environment called methyl mercury. Thimerosal is not methyl mercury. It's a different compounded form of mercury called ethyl mercury. And you can see part of the confusion. People are like, okay, there's you're missing an M. What is really the difference between these two things? And the fundamental difference is that thimerosal leaves the body. Ethyl mercury leaves the body very, very quickly. And so you don't get sort of cumulative buildup of this in your body. The other type of mercury, methyl mercury, which you find in the environment, stays in the body for a very long time. And it's the half-life supposedly is something like 50 days. And can have very long-term toxicities from either people exposure to it over a period of time, over years and years, through diet, through the environment, or people, as has happened several times in history, who are exposed to a massive environmental contamination with mercury and can cause toxicity. But that is a separate thing than the form of mercury that's
used in
the vaccine.
Vaccines. A quick question from Renee, who's driving. Before we take our break, we'll take your call. Renee, go ahead. Huh?
Hi, Dan. Can you hear me?
Yeah, go right ahead.
All right. First of all, thank you for not having an anti-vaxxer on, because if we play that false balance game where, you know, you want to hear both sides, and confusing the issue.
Yeah, I can just read their quotes. I don't need to have them on the air. In fact, we did a couple of hours on anti-vaccine movement and the debunked connection to autism a few years ago after the Lancet article and all that. But anyway, your question for Dr. Smar, please.
Yeah, so my question is, what's the science behind the vaccine schedule? How is it that the CDC and other public health agencies come up with a vaccine schedule?
Good question. How do they come up with that?
That is a great question, and I will make the point that when we come back from break, I do want to talk about that whole debate concept.
Okay.
But, so in terms of Renee's question, it's complex. Again, it's not one person sitting down and saying, this is all the vaccines we're going to give at a certain time. But it has to do with some of its epidemiological, knowing at what age people are at the greatest risk for having diseases. And some of it is based on the populations that were studied in terms of, it. In some cases, it's as easy as I have my vaccine, and for whatever reason, I only decided to study it in kids who are 1 year old as opposed to at 6 months old. And then you have to go back and do other studies. And we had mentioned before in terms of the timing of we typically give the MMR at a certain time, but you can give it much younger because other studies that have been done that have been able to show, well, it could work for this population or this group of people, but due to a number of complex factors, we don't recommend it until this period of time. So it has to do with studies that are done. It has to do with disease epidemiology and practical considerations as well.
410-662-8780. Another break here on Midday on Health with Dr. John Smar. If you have a question about vaccinations, about the measles specifically, please give us a ring. Also, if you have a chance on our Facebook page, Mother Jones has an interesting national map. How many people aren't vaccinating their kids in your state? We took a look at Maryland. We'll tell you what the Mother Jones research reveals about non-vaccinations in Maryland when we get back. Welcome back. I mentioned the Mother Jones map, rate of non-medical vaccine exemptions by state. A national map showing where people aren't vaccinating their kids. We mentioned California, particularly a couple of counties in California, Southern California. But in Maryland, it's pretty low. According to Mother Jones, Maryland is down to like 0.1% to 1% of kindergartners got non-medical vaccine exemptions, one of the lowest rates. Oregon and Vermont have one of the highest rates, according to this map. And also, it's relatively easy to check a box to get an exemption in Maryland, but apparently not that many people do. So I thought I'd throw that in there. You can take a closer look at that interactive map. There's a link to it on the Dan Roderick's Facebook page. Hey, John, we were talking about the schedule of shots for children. Javier wondered about hepatitis B. He says, why is the hepatitis B shot given so early for everybody, while the transmission mode is so unlikely at that age? My kid still shivers each time we mention the doctor's office.
I don't blame your child for shivering every time we mention the doctor's office. Sometimes I do, too. But to seriously answer the question, which is a very good one in terms of, especially if you look at the vaccine schedule, you sort of pull it up and look and see what's given when, and the recommendation is made for so soon. And the reason for that is because there, what we have seen, and again, this goes into what I was talking about before, of different factors that go into when we give people vaccines and how they made up the vaccination schedule, is that, of course, believe it or not, significant numbers of children, at least historically, and even some still today, if they weren't vaccinated, could easily be exposed to hepatitis B during birth from their mother if their mother did not know that they were hepatitis B positive. And the other thing about something like hepatitis B is that this is something that we should be able to, with an effective vaccine, eventually eradicate from humans, because the humans are the main sort of source for this virus. And so that's why it's done, is because, you know, as much as we would like to believe that that folks are getting good prenatal care, we still have significant numbers of women, due to whatever circumstances, unfortunately, who may even show up in labor and they've never sought prenatal care and they've never been tested for hepatitis B. And since it's such an easy thing to potentially transmit during the birthing process and exposure to blood and body fluids there, that's why the vaccine's given then.
A question from Perry Hall, a listener out there named Dee. Welcome to the show, Dee.
Hi, thank you so much. I'm happy to have a chance at my question. My daughter is a child of the 90s, and she was provided with all the appropriate vaccinations and boosters. I, however, am a child of the 50s, and I actually caught all of the childhood diseases, measles, mumps, chickenpox. Which one of us is better protected, my daughter who has had all of the vaccinations, or me who actually suffered through all the diseases?
I feel like this is a family battle that maybe I should be wary about stepping into. No, I'm kidding. So that's a very interesting question, and as far as we can tell, in most cases, when you get a vaccine, the immunity that is generated is comparable to the immunity that you get by actually having had the illness. And there is, as with any of these points that we're talking about, there's a lot of interesting subtleties to discuss that you could go into. But at the end of the day, that's the easiest answer.
So they're about equal, mother,
so they're
mother
about,
and daughter.
About equal, yes.
Yeah. Okay.
And that's also the best for family harmony there. To say, yeah.
All right, here's some important questions from Vince in Linthicum. What does Dr. Smar think should happen with these children that aren't vaccinated and their parents have no plans to have them vaccinated? Should the children be barred from schools, barred from the public? Should the parents be criminally charged for negligence?
That's a way to ask the softball question.
Yeah, the last one is a legal question.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll deal with it.
But no, that's...
But what do you think?
But it's all together.
We've got schools.
It's very important.
Okay.
It's very important because...
You've got the floor,
yeah.
Doc.
So one of the things that has come out over the last few days, which is really interesting, is you hear when some of the folks who are very much anti-vaccine, when they're confronted about this, because that's one of our social phenomena now, is that... I've even seen over the weekend where some anti-vaccine parents or other people have gotten death threats. Of, you know, it's very easy online mm-hmm. to become anonymous and to make and say horrible things without having to have the culpability of sort of owning those statements. And because the situation is inspiring so much emotion. But one of the things that folks there come back with is saying, it's my right as a parent to be able to make those decisions for my child. And from one perspective, that's absolutely true, but let me qualify what I mean by that. It's true because, of course, we as human beings, we're free people. We have the right to make decisions for ourselves, and I firmly believe that. And especially for the people, especially for our children who we're sort of charged with taking care of, who haven't reached a developmental stage yet to be able to make these decisions on their own, that's sort of the role of being a parent. But the problem is that it's counterbalanced by the fact that any choices that we make, anything that we have the right to make, it's all well and good if it just affects us, or say just affects our child. But the hardest thing about this is that when someone makes a decision not to vaccinate their child, that's actually not just their child's problem, because we're talking about health things that we're looking at from a population health standpoint. And when we say things like herd immunity, the idea that if we have enough folks in a big group of people who are immunized to prevent them from getting sick from something, that's not just scientific talk. That's the whole reason why we do this. We give vaccines to people not just for their health, but for the health of everyone. And so that's where I think that argument falls apart, is that, yes, it's your right to make decisions about your own children, but the problem is these decisions are actually potentially affecting other children as well. And that's why it gets hard to answer this question, because that's when we get into law. How do we figure that stuff out as a society?
Right.
That's law, that's
right.
Policy.
Right.
And so,
do you pass a law saying you must get these six vaccines for your child by the time they're 4 months old? You know, it is not your right as a parent to leave your child outside in a freezing winter rain, right?
That's true.
Not expose them to the elements and potential death in that way.
I was trying not to get too much into the ethical.
but that's very true. It was debated.
Mm-hmm.
I had actually a good conversation about this over the weekend, about what you're allowed to do as a parent and not allowed to do.
Or folks who believe very fervently that their religious faith will heal their child or heal themselves from something that we medically know we can very easily treat. What do you do in that situation?
Let's take Dee's call from Pikesville. Dee, welcome to Midday.
Hi. I would like to know how many of the unvaccinated children have come down with autism. I have a granddaughter who was perfectly fine until she received her first shots. And then after that, she had difficulty turning pages. She retreated from everyone, and she started showing signs of autism and has had problems ever since.
So, Dee, that's a great question, and I certainly understand your concern. And I'm going to give you I'm going to step back to give this some context for what my answer is. And that gets back to sort of this tie between vaccines and autism. And essentially, when we say that this association has been debunked, what that is that there have been many very large population-based studies that essentially have looked at this question. They've looked at, we have a group of people, say in a country or a number of countries, most of them probably got vaccinated, but some of them did not. And is there a difference in the rates of autism between the groups that did get vaccinated and those that did not? And the answer to that, with the best of these studies that we've done, is a very clear, there is no difference. And it depends on the study in terms of looking at specific numbers, but that at the end of the day is the important piece with that.
And remember how this story got out there.
Mm-hmm.
It's very clear. It's all on the record. Lancet, the British Medical Journal, published an article by a doctor making this connection. And then that was later, the word is debunked. They found out they pretty much made up the research. The research was either terrible or sort of fabricated. And Lancet had to go a long way to try to correct that. And it definitely contributed to people's belief that there is a connection.
And if you want to read that study, Google Andrew Wakefield Lancet, and
that's
it will
it.
Be the first hit that comes up.
That's it, Andrew Wakefield.
It's very clearly redacted. And what's really interesting, so the full copy of the study is available for free online. What's very interesting is if you read that, you would read that study, and if you didn't know anything else, you would be like, what's the big deal? Because the study, in terms of how it was written, is very conservative, and it's only at the very end in the discussion section, because what he was looking at is he was a gastroenterologist. He was looking in the guts of 12 children, and he claims that what he found there were signs of inflammation, and he wasn't even in that original paper testing for issues with measles, mumps, or rubella, but he brought it up as an issue. However, surrounding that, he did his own press releases. He blew it up to be a really big thing, and it
became something of a celebrity.
Yes,
too.
And it all ended up not having any weight or being factually accurate.
Andrew Wakefield. So you can Google that and read about it, but read it from an authoritative source, the best you can find. Dr. John Smarr is Assistant Director of the Division of Infectious Diseases at Sinai Hospital here in Baltimore. He's also Program Director at Sinai's Internal Medicine Residency Program. He joins us once a month here on Midday on Health to answer our questions and explain all this to us. He does a great job. Thank you so much, John.
Thank you, Dan. I appreciate it.
And thank you, everybody, for tuning in. I hope you enjoyed the program and learned some things. Please come back tomorrow. Have a great afternoon.
Midday senior producer is Nikki Gamer. The producer is Maureen Harvey. The associate producer is Michael Himowitz. Our interns are Carrie DeSantis, David Richmond, and Marjorie Goodman. Midday's engineer is Luke Spicknell. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcast and live streaming is available at WYPR.org. Dan Rogic's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.